Welcome to the Science Off Camera podcast, where we are talking to scientists around the world about their research and its impact, what made them pursue their scientific fields, and how they use imaging and spectroscopy in their labs. My name is Sebastian Remy, and my guest today is Professor Christy Landis from Rice University. We talked about the research in her lab using mathematical and signal processing methods combined with microscopy and super-resolution microscopy, as well as the challenges of handling and understanding the large amounts of data generated by microscopy experiments, and how to keep up with the fast pace of progress in science. This podcast is brought to you by Teledyne Princeton Instruments, leading manufacturer of scientific cameras and spectrographs for low-light measurements from X-rays to infrared light. Discuss your application and book an online product demonstration at princetoninstruments.com. Today, my guest is Christy Landis, a professor in chemistry and electrical and computer engineering. I hope I said that right. And calling in from beautiful Houston, Texas, from Rice University. And Christy, I would like to ask you to introduce yourself and kind of what research kind of you're doing roughly, and then we can talk in more details. My belief is our listeners are kind of a big mixture. Some are microscopists and people right. who are more in areas like you, but a lot of people also from physical science and that are maybe more unrelated fields. So tell them kind of what you are about and what you are doing.
Got it. Thanks for having me. I watched some of the other podcasts and I really enjoyed them. So thank you for doing this. I hope it's interesting. So as you said, I'm in the chemistry department. That's my primary appointment. My PhD is in physical chemistry, so I'm a chemist. But it's also true that everything now is so interdisciplinary. It just depends on your department, where you find like-minded people. And one of the things that I realized, I don't know, maybe just 5 years or so into my research program, is that I was super interested in signal processing, that doing single molecule microscopy, which is what I'd kind of migrated, you know, away from bulk spectroscopy and pump probe things, that was my PhD, towards, you know, single molecule measurement for my postdoc, and then, you know, into super resolution for my faculty work, that signal and image processing is such an important part of, you know, modern microscopy, especially if you want to be pushing, you know, what you're able to learn from your sample. And at least at Rice anyway, our we have a tradition at Rice that our electrical and computer engineering department was very instrumental in signal processing in the days when fiber optic communication was going under sea cable and things like that. So a bunch of the algorithms that were developed for how to multiply undersea fiber optic communications and multiply the signal and suppress the noise were big there. And so I found some colleagues there early to just have conversations with and realize one of my senior colleagues, Naomi Hollis, she was like, you know, that means you're an electrical engineer, right? And I said, oh, I didn't know what it was that I cared about. And so, but you know, that just kind of shows that it's possible to be so insular in your PhD training that you don't actually know what you're doing. And so she was like, what you're doing is electrical engineering. Super. And so that's been really helpful to be able to recruit some electrical engineering students and to really even more collaborate with my electrical and computer engineering colleagues at Rice on that topic, because I really am very interested in signal image processing and trying to get as much you know, information in these types of data sets that are so information sparse, right? There's so much data and hardly any of it means anything. Most of it is background or noise or things like that. And so that's something that very much interests me. And then you missed something in terms of my last appointment is in chemical and biomolecular engineering.
Okay, sorry.
but that's okay, because I am a chemist because I'm interested in, you know, molecules and dynamics at the molecular scale, not the bulk scale. I'm using signal processing to try to develop new ways to do microscopy, but the problem I'm interested in turns out to be to overlap better, at least in the US anyway, with what chemical engineering departments care about, which is I got super passionate, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 years into my faculty work, my colleague in chemical engineering at UH brought me an interesting problem in separation science, which I promise. Sebastian, what is your degree in?
Physics.
All right, so you never had to take analytical chemistry.
No, will be embarrassing myself now. I was super bad in chemistry. I have like two left hands, putting things together and like.
You and me both. Until I got to physical chemistry, I was like having a crisis. I was like, there's no way I'm an organic chemist. Like I never had anything in my filter frit ever. the other problem for me was analytical chemistry. I'm honest that I slept through, I'm sure, a lot of analytical chemistry. I found it super boring and I didn't know why at the time. And when my colleague brought me this problem of trying to understand how to relate basically electrostatics the way chemists would, mm-hmm. or physicists would describe electrostatics, with this bulk problem of ion-based, so charge-based separations for, you know, at that time, the very new market of protein biologic separations for some pharmaceuticals. The bulk chemical engineering description just didn't match the chemistry, you know, observations. And so he challenged me to design a single molecule or a super resolution experiment to test a hypothesis. And then I got just completely sucked in. This is my like Don Quixote quest. Like I realized that separation science is not science as a physicist or a chemist would define science. It is engineering. It's all empirical approximations, and then when your empirical approximation doesn't work, you make an extension to fix it, mm-hmm. you know, etc., etc. I mean, it's not science, and it can be, is the point. Like, it actually, you know, in the 20s and 30s and 40s, when separations were becoming industrially important, no, it had to be engineering. There weren't computers good enough to do the math. There weren't experiments to really, you know, detangle what was going on, but now I can. And so that's my reason for existence now. Like I want to make separation science.
So can you give an example what people kind of do in separation science? I'm not so
okay
familiar with it.
So have you heard of chromatography?
Yes.
All right. So chromatography is something that if you've made something in a chemistry or biochemistry lab, you've used chromatography to separate it. When we buy, you know, materials from a supplier, they've done chromatography to separate it. Or how it's done by just everyday people like you or me, if we were ever miserable enough to try to to try to do that, because it is miserable. It's all experience and folklore of how to pack your column and what materials to use and how long to make your column and what pressure to use. So for everyday people, they just do it based on how they were taught to do it, and they might mess with a few parameters here or there. Now, if you're trying to optimize, there is an empirical equation called the Van Diemter equation that's very useful and extremely descriptive of the engineer, like of the rheology, for example. It has to do with like bulk flow and deviations from ballistic pathways. But it doesn't have anything to do with the actual physical processes that are happening when molecules in a wet mobile phase are interacting with the surface of the stationary phase. And it has a lot of really interesting physics. You know, all the classical transport models break down mm-hmm. in these charged, crowded interfacial transport with pressure put on them, usually with all sorts of proteins that can unfold and dimerize and compete and things like that. So the bulk descriptions just are not sufficient to describe competitive adsorption, say, at a surface, or the fact that transport on a surface isn't Brownian, certainly isn't Fickian, and there's all this nonlinear stuff happening as something exchanges between the mobile phase and the stationary phase. So there's interesting new physics and chemistry here that if we just look closely enough, which now, thanks to, you know, modern, you know, optics technology, we're able to, we can have a better description of these processes.
So what does the single molecular approach kind of bring to the table now? I think I have an idea of what that might be.
So the first problem that we solved, this is the piece where, like, again, I fully believe in doing this like a scientist. So we start with a hypothesis to test, and then can you design an experiment to test it? So that first problem that my engineering colleague brought to me was, the bulk equations say that the charge at the interface determines, simply a simple electrostatic equation determines how attracted an oppositely charged analyte is to that surface. Okay, simple electrostatics. And then you can tune that, you know, the Debye length by tuning, say, the ionic strength of the solution, mm-hmm. right, say. But they had some data that showed that it actually, because the Debye length is so big, it shouldn't care how the charges are there, right? Mm-hmm. It's way bigger than the scale of molecules, say, or bonds. But they had some ensemble data that showed if you clustered your charges into polypeptides or just put individual charges there, they got a different answer, even though the numbers of charges were the same. Now, the bulk discrepancies don't explain that behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we basically designed a super resolution experiment so that we could have cluster charges on a solid support, mm-hmm. and then individual charges, and measure the kinetics of adsorption and desorption. And that's one of the cool, awesome things about this single molecule methods is you can measure the rate constants and not just the equilibrium constants, mm-hmm. and determine so the adsorption, the desorption rates at individual ligands, either the single ligands or the charged ligands, and demonstrate for sure that it's not just electrostatics that controls that interaction. There's a steric component as well.
So I find it always so fascinating how people kind of get to their ideas. And sometimes in science in particular, on the one hand, of course, there's such a wide world out there and it's such a complex world, right? There's always more riddles, but often it seems like, oh, we understand this really well. And you kind of described kind of a problem or something people were doing, and they kind of...
The engineers are totally confident they understand this, right? Like, they're totally confident they understand this. And they do understand it. So I don't want to undersell, like, you know, the global, I don't know, petrochemical, plastics, pharmaceutical market is multi-hundreds of billions of dollars that rely on smart people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Knowing what they're doing, you know.
In terms of selecting just like kind of your research topic, right? If I understood you right, a colleague of you kind of exposed you to this area. And it's always... I don't know what made you kind of jump on that, or like, and what does it kind of mean for everyone? Because someone who starts their career now and their research, they have to find new problems to work on. And
it is difficult to know what new problem to choose. And I would be interested to know, you know, what your philosophy is, because I do think, so if you talk about what you are, I'm a chemist. Tools that you use, you know, optics and signal processing, and a problem that you want to work on. I also think it's important to understand your philosophy of how to put all these things together. And I'm not saying mine's the right one, but I really need to feel like I can make a difference, because all of us are so small in the ground, you know, all of us are so small. And even if you do try to make a difference, the likelihood is that none of us will, right? Like, that's just how, like, all of us are doing, pushing our tiny little piece of the universe forward, and we need to be happy and satisfied with that, like, eventual outcome, right? Like, that needs to be the assumption that, like, none of what I do will mean something. But at least I feel like if I try to find an area that's not oversaturated, you know, that my unique skill set could potentially add something that nobody else can do, then that's why I would pick that. And that's why I did pick this, that it's certainly in the US. There are people in Europe, a couple groups, both in theory groups and experimental groups, that are doing kind of similar things to what we're doing. But I really felt like this is a place in the US that I could make a unique contribution. Now, will it mean anything in the end? that's for time and the universe to figure out, but that's how I choose. Can I do something unique?
it's kind of fascinating to me to hear these stories, because it involves, I know it's a combination of hard work, taking kind of maybe even a little bit of leap of faith, and just and
it's a lot, I think, a lot of, I mean, we're scientists, and so we don't want to talk about those kind of things a lot, but I do think a lot of this stuff is believing. Now, is it just believing in yourself, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, believing in your, you know, that your hypothesis has merit, or, you know, something like that. But the other thing I think that's, again, this is just me, I really not only don't mind, but also really like being the dumbest person in the room on a, like, I like leaping into a new field and mm-hmm. not knowing what the hell I'm doing.
Yeah.
And so that I can learn something.
Yeah.
And so for sure on that topic, I legit knew virtually nothing. And so it's been, and I still am learning. And so I like that feeling too, that I don't know everything.
I was looking on your website, and you talked about some of the projects you're working on. You talked about the vast amounts of data kind of you collect. So,
yeah. So I can give you an example if you want, especially because you're a physicist too, okay? One of the things, and I'm not finished with this either, you know, this is something I really hope I can, it oscillates. I'm sure it's the same way for a lot of people, but a company really has to be much more goal focused and not, you know, the path focused. And so everything in research, I think, really waxes and wanes depending on what students you get, what their background is, what their strengths and weaknesses are, what funding you have, you know, all those mm-hmm. things. And so my signal processing at the moment is not as strong in my research focus as I would like it to be, but that's basically just a function of, you know, timing and things like that. But where I really got passionate about this, and I'm not sure how old you are, so I won't ask you, but I will tell you how old I am in terms of research stuff. So as a spectroscopist, as a grad student working with pump probe, in those days, how things worked was, I mean, you had a sample, fine, and it might have taken a lot of effort or little effort. I was one of those physical chemists that, like, hopefully someone else made a fancy sample and I could just measure it, okay? But basically you spent all of your time aligning and calibrating your instrument many, many, many hours, right? to get it just right with the temperature and the, you know, everything aligned properly. And, you know, sometime late at night, you would start to get data. And by data, that means one point, right? Like one data point. And then maybe if you stayed till like 3 or 4 in the morning and it wasn't a thunderstorm or a train didn't come by or like someone didn't run in and slam the door, whatever, maybe you would have like 6 or 7, or if you're super lucky, 10 data points, you know, in that night, right, of work. And you might be in those 10 data points, you might be collecting a spectrum, or you might be collecting a kinetic curve, and you would fit that data point once you'd averaged it with your 4 other nights, you know, whatever, to something simple, an exponential decay, a Gaussian, you know, Lorentzian, whatever. And in that situation, each one of those data points is precious, right?
Yeah.
Each one of those data points means hopefully an equal amount, but each one of them is really important to fitting that exponential decay. Now, today, especially in single molecule and super resolution, you collect, you know, with these incredibly high resolution cameras, that's just one frame, right? You know, lots and lots and lots of bits and bytes of data, and then a movie, you know, some of our experiments with the 3D stuff can be like a terabyte of one experiment. So that's not, you know, 8 data points, that's like trillions of data points. But most of them don't mean anything, right? Most of them are nothing. And there's all sorts of really fun information science concepts that you can incorporate into chemistry and physics, I mean, that the signal processing people have been doing, you know, for years, and now, you know, physicists and chemists are starting to do it too, with things like, you know, compressive sensing and things like that to change the way we weigh our data. The ordinary way that a physicist or a chemist would fit those 8 points is with the least squares optimization. A least squares optimization basically, you know, gives you a set of parameters based on the notion that every single data point is worth the same amount. But if we did that, you know, anything that has anything to do with least squares in our data, we would get the wrong answer because most of it would be all averaged out to nothing. And so that's kind of the principles immediately at the start that you see that we can't use traditional ways, or we shouldn't be using traditional ways to treat our data. But we also at the same time, you know, one of the other things that's very tempting in the early days of single molecule, if you have, you know, a really good signal to background, is you can see with your eyes where your molecule is. And so the opposite of what, you know, so on the one hand, least squares optimization says we treat every pixel the same, in which case everything would be averaged out to nothing. But then the other bad case is we pick with our eyes and we bias our analysis of a sample. And so, you know, incorporating these new, or at least new to chemistry and physics, signal processing principles and information science principles into analysis is something that, that I think is really cool.
Can you give more specifics about kind of the scale involved in your experiments, like how much data it is you're taking?
Easily gigas. So our group is interested in dynamics. So like our movies are not for photoblink statistics like they would be in, you know, storm or paint, but instead in like following things that are moving over time in potentially certainly two dimensions, but potentially three dimensions. And so easily that's many gigabytes of data. Sometimes it's terabytes, but usually always it's gigabytes.
I saw this presentation about this light sheet technique, and you could kind of see the complexity that's going there. So
now we just hired a new person at Rice, Anna Karin Gustafsson, who specializes in light sheet. We're super excited to have her. Like, it's such a great technology.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating, and the amount of detail you have, but also the amount of data you produce, you have to look through. And if I find it interesting actually now to think back when I was in grad school, that was around the time when the LHC at CERN kind of was under construction.
Nice.
And opened during my time. And that was also one of the, I don't know if the statement is right that it was one of the first big data experiments, but I remember that from 20 years ago, that in the design of that, they had to think so, and with the computer systems of the day, right, back then, they had to think about, oh, we will produce these giant amounts
of data. And I think also astronomy, you know, astronomy has a similar issue that they take super wide, often super wide field, you know, images of, you know, regions of space where there's nothing or mostly not the thing that you want to detect. There's several fields. Medical imaging is another place where they collect tons and tons of data, and they actually don't use most of what they collect. They don't have time, right? Like someone gets a CT scan because they have, you know, thyroid cancer. There's no time to process that data and optimize it. A person has to decide where the cancer is and how to treat it.
Mm-hmm. And that brings me, I guess, to the question. I find the question already interesting, you talked a little bit about how you use techniques you learned to process that data, and there's new ways of processing the data. There's the challenge of just like storing and keeping that data. But how do you not miss anything, right? You said, okay, in my early days, I took 4 data points. That was kind of my PhD thesis almost, right?
Yep.
And it took forever.
Exactly.
It was really simple.
Especially physicists, right?
Yeah, like... yeah. But now in a day, you can take probably data you can analyze.
You can spend the whole rest
years.
Of your career analyzing it. Yeah. So first of all, we do miss things, right? Like it just has to be definition, like equals, you know, with that much data and that much processing time and people time to do it, like it has to be true, right, by definition that we miss things. And I have to say that, I don't know, it was true as a grad student that, you know, especially at the end when you kind of know what you're doing, like that my boss would be like, oh, Christy, can you go back and look at this thing that you found 6 months ago? And I was like, I'm not interested in it. I want to look at something new, you know. So this is been going on for a long time, but for sure there's things that I could come up with right now that I could give examples of, like, I friggin' know there's something in that data that is more than what we're saying. But it's also, I mean, that's, things have to go forward and you just kind of have to be able to sleep at night.
Yeah, you mentioned astronomy, and I know there are these big telescopes that take a lot of data and people work for years and years to analyze it. Is that something that's in the biochemistry, biomedical field happening now as well? Or is the development so fast that you say, it's not really worth it to, this is old data, right? It's kind of safe, but we have like big dumps for it. We have now much better, higher resolution techniques again.
I really think we're not doing that as much as we should be doing. You know, just the point that you're saying, like with a lot of, especially medical things or national security things, you know, things like that, those are pressing, urgent, you know, problems. If someone's dying, you got to help them now. For example, you know, if someone's, I don't know, attacking, you got to deal with it now. But I want to believe that people, epidemiologists, you know, that's their job, like scoring. And that's a lot of the stuff that's happening right now with the pandemic that we talked about a little bit before we started recording, that there's so much data here that we have, that I really hope that somebody who is in that field looks at it. One of the things I'm fascinated about, I hope they don't miss it, but in the beginning, while they were still figuring out whether a vaccine was even possible, do you remember reading all the data that showed that, you know, if you'd gotten a particular type of tuberculosis vaccine, that the data was showing that there was a lower incidence rate. So there must be something about getting, say, the measles, mumps, rubella, particular version of it vaccine. And my goodness, isn't that an interesting, you know, question? Our acquired immune system and our innate immune system are supposed to be different, but the data says there's something there. I hope someone's looking at it. But it also, I don't know if this is true, but this is one of my theories about why I am personally seeing fewer PhD students who want to work on this field. My PhD students who do work on that, they basically get snapped up by industry. They certainly get snapped up before they finish their PhD, but basically there's just a huge demand for people who have expertise in that. And I suspect even from having a bachelor's degree, there's people who have interest and expertise in that. So I think there's a shortage of, it's certainly if you're interested in that, I think it's a field, and especially at the intersections of physics or chemistry or medicine or some sort of engineering, it's a great place to go if you're starting your career to go, because I don't see that demand lessening in the years to come. And it certainly seems to be right now a very smart place to be.
Is it the computational kind of skills you acquire, or?
I think so, yeah. Don't you? I mean, it's mostly, and in particular, so computational skills, absolutely. But also, you know, it's like that quote of like, in theory and practice are the same thing, but in practice it's not. Like, it also takes a computational person who gets that. Yeah. That just because your simulation says it's this doesn't mean you've thought of everything, and you need to be able to incorporate the actual data into your model. So those special, not all experimentalists can talk to theoreticians, and not all theoreticians can talk to experimentalists. So it also needs to be a computational person who's super comfortable with kind of straddling that world, I think. So that's also a rare skill.
Yeah. So one thing I saw on your website, like the two kind of connecting pieces among all people on the podcast, is that they do imaging or spectroscopy in one form or the other. So you talk a lot about spectroscopy in your on your website. I just didn't quite understand what that means in your case exactly. And so,
well, and the things that I've told you about, it means virtually nothing.
Yeah.
Because the examples that we have here are mostly just microscopy and imaging.
Yeah.
Now, with our microscope, we do some FRET imaging, which is, if you squint and are generous, that's spectroscopy, because you're separating by, you know, the wavelength of light. But our spectroscopic imaging is really done in collaboration with Stefan Link at Rice, because plasmonic nanoparticles are fascinating things to begin with, in terms of their interaction with light. But what I like them for is that their plasmon resonance is such sensitive reporter of what's happening at the surface of it. Yeah. And so we've built two or three different home-built hyperspectral imaging microscopes where we're able to take an image of a bunch of nanoparticles that maybe have proteins or polymers or, you know, whatever on top of them. And then we're able to detect the spectra of all those nanoparticles in a single shot and even do that dynamically. That's the other important thing. You can watch, like, say, reactions happening at the surface of nanoparticles by just monitoring their spectra. So our spectroscopic imaging is almost all done with nanoparticles, mm-hmm. and in scattering, some absorption, but mostly scattering mode.
What pieces of information do you exactly get from the spectroscopic observations?
So plasmonic nanoparticles absorb and scatter light super strongly in the visible, well, for gold and silver, there's other nanoparticles that do it in other parts of the spectrum, but in the visible part of the spectrum. For single nanoparticles, the interesting thing, you know, from a physics perspective, there's no way you'd ever want to do this in ensemble, because individual nanoparticles, when they interact with light, are a resonator. And so it's like dinging a bell, basically. And so the decay of that plasmon resonance is exactly a Lorentzian. You know, it is a damped oscillator. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, it's really important. If you really want to get quantitative information about reactions or structure or things like that at the surface, you must take spectra of individual nanoparticles, because it's just intimately connected. That piece, the physics is known, maybe not perfectly, but really close to perfectly, yeah. exactly the contributions from electron-electron interactions with the lattice of the nanoparticle, the lattice coupling to the surrounding, blah, 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 all that, you know, all that really, you know, detailed physics. And so if we want to do something like see how a protein is unfolding on nanoparticle surfaces, we would image those in hyperspectral mode and collect, so you have some combination. We've been using a transmission grating so that on a single, that's one of the advantages of like these big, nice chips now,
yeah.
like on a single chip, you can split it. On one half of the chip, you can localize an image, and on the other half of the chip, you spread out the light using a slit, and then you can detect, you can match, you know, individual particles with its spectrum, mm-hmm. and then fit the spectra and watch that. That's one frame, and then of course take a movie and then watch that change as a function of time.
I'm really curious where that will go in the future. I had talked to a bunch of people on the podcast about who were doing pump probe, kind of what you did in the past, and how they want to bring this to a, like bring the chemical dimension kind of in there, right? If you just look at a microscopic image, you just see where particles kind of are, you
right.
understand kinetics,
exactly.
but the whole chemistry that is going on, you don't have.
Like ideally you could see, you know, if we know how, I guess it just depends on what you're interested in, right? You know, it depends,
yeah.
because we don't, it's crazy that we don't know simply the structure of things like cells or neurons or things like that with the level of detail we'd like to, right? So
yeah.
that's all true. But also I think just the interesting stuff about, like, so many pieces of disease development are about dynamics. You know, the methylation events that lead to, you know, DNA damage, the what happens before amyloid fibers form.
Yeah.
You know, what happens before that? What happens to cause metastasis, right? For a cell to get from your, you know, lung to your brain, you know, that's not supposed to happen. And so there's all these, like, you know, chemistry signaling events that has to happen. So there's a lot to be done here.
Yeah, and you add a couple of more dimensions to the data you produce in addition to the spectral
right,
data.
The spectral, yeah, the spectral information and you know, when bonds are being formed and broken would be really important there.
So the students who are starting in your lab, what are kind of the backgrounds, and what in your particular research is it more than that they pick up the computational skills? How much is on the optics and setup microscopy kind of development side? What is it they do kind of day in and day out?
So it depends on where they're from. right? In the US, it's very rare for an undergrad in the US to get experience on a real home-built spectroscopy or home-built microscope system, right? That's not something we have our undergrads doing here usually. And certainly, it's not something that at a primary undergraduate institution that they would be able to afford, right? So they just wouldn't have access to that. So if they're from the US, they certainly have to learn the optics and spectroscopy. More and more students are coming in now with programming experience and more with Python experience, which I think is good that schools are switching over to teaching that, because it's such a useful language to do for scientific and programming. There's so many scripts available, things like that. So my chemistry students that I recruit, I try to recruit physical chemistry students because the math is hard. And mm-hmm. So you can't go back and learn that, right? You know, you either know how to do that or you don't know how to do that. So I think that's a thing in our group that I've kind of just decided you have to have a physical chemistry background if you're a chemist. And then I also have applied physics students who are really wonderful because they come in with having, you know, certainly a strong physics background, but just the notion that they feel like physics is kind of Swiss Army knife of science and engineering. You can always apply physics knowledge to something. And then the electrical engineers tend to be great programmers and great at math and things like that. So I think it just depends.
We had also a couple graduate students on the podcast, and the times changed just so quickly. I feel already, so I graduated 7 years ago, but I feel so far removed already. And I'm in universities all the time. I talk to researchers, yeah. But just
it's crazy how quickly science and the state of the art progresses. But this is also one of the things I think that makes it very difficult for new parents. You know, it's difficult to take time off from this and be able to keep up. But on the other hand, you have to take time off from this. This is a reason why this is a challenge, and it's not easy to fix. Because things legit, if you jump off, by the time you jump back on, like, it's a different train.
Yeah. It's absolutely amazing how rapidly things evolve, and to our benefit. I mean, you mentioned the pandemic and just the speed with which the vaccine came now about. Of course, all the research that went into that over the past decades, it's right?
Incredible.
But it's
multiple
amazing.
Decades.
Yeah, and that would be kind of cool to see. I was thinking like a couple weeks ago. Oh, I wonder, just like in 10 years, who knows? Like people will might be able to do this in a few weeks, right? Have more advanced computer models, and there's so much work that still can be done, needs to be done. And science plays so an important aspect in it, and it from all, not just computationally, but also kind of microscopy spectroscopy.
And I don't know about you, but you know, to my when I'm having, you know, my Zoom happy hours with friends who aren't scientists, you know, one of the points that I really try to make is that mRNA wasn't even known, you know, like just a reasonable time ago, and certainly thought not to, you know, it kind of went through a period where there were people who were like, oh, it's not important. It doesn't do anything. And it can't do anything because just by definition, it's small and it degrades so quickly. And so that the two vaccines that we have are based on that, are based on technology that is from fundamental science that was legit discovery science, right? Real discovery science. It really shows, and wasn't fast either, like that there's a vaccine is like a miracle of technology, but the mRNA knowledge behind it is decades old, just like you said. And the same thing, there's medicine, there's biology, there's physics, there's technology with the imaging, and thank God for computers, right? You know, it's really quite something.
I think that was a good last word kind of on the episode. Thank you so much. This was such a lovely conversation. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Exactly. It was great for me.
Thanks again to Christy Landis from Rice University for being on this episode of Science Off Camera. Check out the show notes to learn more about Christy's research and more information. If you enjoyed this episode, it would be amazing if you would consider subscribing on your favorite podcast platform and follow Princeton Instruments on social media to get updated about new episodes. Check out PrincetonInstruments.com for the latest in scientific camera and spectroscopy technology for physical and life sciences. See you next time and have a great day.